we're going to stop at Genesis, before Genesis 3 today. So we're just going to focus primarily on Genesis 1. Before I do that, however, I would like to just give a special welcome to two of our guests, who's our friends from Tebisa, Lebogang and Thabang, the Ang brothers. And they are a gentleman sitting here in the middle, and you guys know that we are very much affiliated with Tembisa. And thank you so much, Thabang and Lebogang, for making the trouble to get over here and fellowship with us. We apologize for the fact that we do not worship remotely as well as you guys do. It's a well-known fact that when white people dance and sing, it's not necessarily glorifying God. So bear with us as we go through this. But thank you so much for being here, and we are just so grateful that you guys came. I would like to start off by showing you this little clip over here. Before that, is that our first one? Okay, all right. Well, I would like to start off by reading you the following clip. All right. It goes like this. Although South Africa managed to get a good foundation through their openness, they didn't kick on from that momentum. Also, when the field is as big as the one they are playing on, it is hard to clear the boundaries, and therefore we shouldn't be surprised that so many batsmen were caught in the deep. To be honest, I don't think they have enough to defend, but all depends on how the power play is being utilized by both teams. On this relatively good pitch, I would suggest that 155 is a par score. But anything less becomes difficult. We can only hope that the bowlers get off to a good start. Genesis 1, verses 1 to 5, obviously. Old Testament, that's why you guys don't know what it's about. Who has any idea what I just spoke about? Okay, Derek puts his hand. Who has no idea what I just read? No context, Alvara. Okay, the rest of you, do you know that I'm at least talking about cricket? Okay, so we've got that down. All right, that's good. Against whom do you think is South Africa playing? Firstly, we can conclude that South Africa is playing because I said, although South Africa managed. So I know it's rocket science. So against whom do you think is South Africa playing? Australia. Why do you say that? Large fields. Okay, well, Arnold is well-traveled or well-TV'd. It says in the beginning, the openers, although the openers managed to get a good foundation, what does that mean? First two batsmen. But come on, Derek Willem, you are the only guys who's got a life and follow sport, so please tell me, what am I referring to? Okay, all right. Who batted first, according to this little passage that we just told you? Australia? South Africa? Yeah. And then, what is a power play? Who has no idea, who's never heard of a power play in sport before? Okay, a couple of hands in front, girls not representing all that well. And then it says, a par score on this pitch would be 155. So what format do you think are we talking about? Test format, okay, between Bangladesh and somebody worse. All right, so this is not going at all as I've planned. It's a T20. It's a T20. All right. Now, was this passage that I just read to you, was it written to all people over all cultures or whatever? You can say it was written for them. In other words, anybody can read it, but it's not necessarily written to them. So not everybody would understand it directly. And that is what they call, there's what you call high context and low context. High contexts are people who are familiar with the situation. So they would be people who follow cricket. You are then very much within that high context. You must have a basic knowledge of the game because this guy doesn't care to explain power play. He assumes that you know what the power play is. You understand that? This guy doesn't explain stuff like openers. He doesn't explain stuff like pitch, pass, score, anything, because he assumes you've got a basic knowledge of what cricket is all about. Now, what's even more interesting is that my dad was a cricket lover. That's not that interesting. But what is interesting is that my dad would not have understood all of this passage. You know why? Because when he lived, there wasn't such a thing as T20. And he would have been rather bamboozled to hear that 155 is a par score for any game. Because when he lived, the two formats, which was Test cricket and ODI cricket, and not in one of those games is 155 a very good score. So it is very clear from this text that you need some knowledge, you need to be in a particular context, in a particular time, to fully understand this passage. Is that, that is not something that I need to explain any further. Who of you saw the game, and I know this is very much the wrong crowd to do this, but who of you saw the game between America and the All Blacks a while ago? All right. We've got a historian and an auditor who saw it. Now, what was amazing about this game, by the way, if you don't like sport, it's okay. You can go and watch that game because it's America, and they Hollywooded up a rugby game. It's never been that entertaining to watch a game of rugby ever. They've got these American commentators who's very excited about the game of rugby. And when the game started off, they say, all right, so the All Blacks are beginning with their haka, and That's go, and they're going to kick the ball off. In rugby, you're not allowed to pass the ball forward. You may pass it flat or backwards. And Sonny Bill Williams passes the ball to him. Now the ball is kicked out. Now they're going to restart with a line-out. A line-out is how they start a rugby game once the ball is out. All right, he throws it in. He's not allowed to throw the ball in skew. Ball is perfect, ball out. So they did a fantastic job. Let's just go back to South African accent. They did a fantastic job in explaining this game. Why? Because America is a low context culture in terms of rugby. So that guy explains everything, and it's broadcast on national American on NBC. So there's a lot of people who gets to watch the game, and because the people don't understand, he explains it as he goes. He doesn't assume that anybody understands it. When we watch, for instance, rugby with Afrikaans commentary, I mean, those guys, because if you're too Afrikaner, you would know about the rugby, and they are not going to explain to you. They are just going to give you the facts of what's happening at that very moment in the game, because it is a high context scenario. So what I'm trying to tell you with my sports analogy is that context is very, very important. It's all around us, if I can make it sound more dramatic. Now, with that in mind, let's quickly read the Genesis account. And this time, I would read it for real. All right. First, this. I'm reading from the Message translation. God created the heavens and earth. All you see, all you don't see. Earth was a soup of nothingness, a bottomless emptiness, an inky blackness. God's spirit brooded like a bird above the watery abyss. God spoke, light, and light appeared. God saw that light was good and separated light from darkness. God named the light day. He named the dark night. It was evening. It was morning. Day one. God spoke. Sky. In the middle of the watery abyss, separate water from water. God made sky. He separated the water under the sky from the water above sky. And there it was. He named sky the heavens. It was evening. It was morning. Day two. God spoke, separate, water beneath heaven, gather into one place, land appear, and there it was. God named the land earth, he named the pooled water ocean. God saw that it was good. God spoke, earth, green up, grow all varieties of seed-bearing plants, every sort of fruit-bearing tree, and there it was. Earth produced green seed-bearing plants, all varieties, and fruit-bearing trees of all sorts. God saw that it was good. It was evening, it was morning, day three. God spoke, lights, come out, shine in heaven, sky, separate day from night, mark seasons and days and years, lights in heaven, sky to give light to earth, and there it was. God made two big lights, the larger to take charge of day, the smaller to be in charge of night, and he made the stars. God placed them in the heavenly sky to light up earth and oversee day and night, to separate light and dark. God saw that it was good. It was evening. It was morning. Day four. God spoke, swarm ocean with fish and all sea life. Birds fly through the sky over earth. God created the huge whales, all the swarm of life in the waters, and every kind and species of flying birds. God saw that it was good. God blessed them, prosper, reproduce, fill the ocean. Birds reproduce the earth, or reproduce on earth. And it was evening, it was morning, day five. God spoke, earth, generate life, every sort and kind, cattle and reptiles and wild animals, all kinds. And there it was, wild animals of every kind, cattle of all kinds, every sort of reptile and bug. God saw that it was good. God spoke, let us make human beings in our image, make them reflecting our nature, so they can be responsible for the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, the cattle, and yes, earth itself. And every animal that move on earth, on the face of the earth, God created human beings. He created them in God-likeness. Reflecting God's nature, he created them male and female. God blessed them. Prosper, reproduce, fill earth, take charge. Be responsible for fish in the sea and birds in the air, for every living thing that moves on the face of the earth. Then God said, I've given you every sort of seed-bearing plant on earth and every kind of fruit-bearing tree, given them to you for food, to all animals and all birds, everything that moves and breathes. I give whatever grows out of the ground for food. And there it was. God looked over everything he had made. It was good. It was so very good. It was evening. It was morning. Day six. Heaven and earth were finished, down to the last detail. By the seventh day, God had finished his work. On the seventh day, he rested from all his work. God blessed the seventh day. He made it a holy day, because on that day, he rested from his work. All the creating God had done. This is the story, how it all started, of heaven and earth, when they were created. Now, I realize that there's a lot of controversy when it comes to this issue. There's a lot of controversy whenever we talk about the age of the earth. And this is the allure, so I would expect nothing less that it's going to be controversial today as well. And when we open up for Q&A, you guys can kill me or make your remarks and whatever. But whenever we hear this, there's certain dogmatic buttons that immediately is pressed. And what do you think when we hear this? You think about the age of the earth. It didn't help that Herman suggested that we're talking about the age of the earth. That is not what this is advertised. It's advertised as the days of Genesis, mind you, not the age of the earth. But Herman's outside now, probably ashamed of what he did. But before we do that, let me remind you of this issue of high context and low context, of this issue of context. In other words, we must try and think what the first readers of this text, what would they have seen in this text? And it's a difficult task, but it's also a fun one. So let's just do that trick for a while. Forget about the controversy about modern science and how this all overlaps. What would the first readers of this text, what would they have understood? Whether it was Moses who wrote it, I'm not even interested in debating the authorship, or whether it was written in the Babylonian exile, the first readers of this, until actually quite recently, would have realized the following. They would have been shocked at a couple of things. The first one is this. This passage, this Genesis account, this Genesis 1, says that the world came into existence without a fight. That is ridiculous. That is stupid. Why do I say that? Because in almost all mythologies, all religions, all accounts of ancient creation stories, you know how it happened? They were almost always fighting. Two gods fighting. So it's a cosmic god fight. So I would think that people who saw this for the first time would be rather annoyed at how boring the story is, because there's no gods fighting. So how it would usually go, gods would fight against one another, one of the gods would die, and out of his carcass, a new world will sprout. That's why some might say that those kind of religions in those days were much cooler than what we have today. But that would be the first thing that they would pick up on. Why isn't any gods fighting? Because this is a PG, you don't even have an age restriction on this creation story. It's very it's very subtle, it's very family friendly. That's the first thing. Nobody's dying in this account, and that would have shocked people. That's the first thing. Remember, we are trying to think the people who this was written to, what they would have considered. The second thing that would have been absolutely shocking to them is that the sea is not a god. If you wanted to tell a person living in the ancient Near East that the ocean is not a god, I mean, that is blasphemy. That is absolute blasphemy. Because when you look at the sea, it is dodgy. It's got godlike status. The Greeks, I think, called it Poseidon. Before them, there's millions of names for the god of the sea. And that god better be respected. You better build a temple as close to the sea so that the sea god can see, no pun intended, the temple that's built for him so that he can relax. If the sea is upset, we need to make a sacrifice of some sort. And if Jonah or anybody else is on board, you need to throw him over because somebody annoyed the sea god and we need to appease this thing. So the Jonah story actually acknowledges people's fear of the sea god. All right? So I think a lot of people would say, God creating the waters, although it doesn't speak exactly say the waters, the oceans that filled up, it's not a god, it's creation. Nah, blasphemy. Would have shocked a person who's heard this story for the first time. But it gets worse. Because these guys were pretty close to Egypt. And Egypt was a big player. It was a superpower in the ancient Near East. And those of you who've ever been to Egypt, there's one thing that stands out, even more than the pyramids. It's the sun. And if you stand out, whilst the sun is standing out, you are going to come down with some serious sunburn. It is, now listen, if you've ever been there, there's a reason why they worshipped the sun. Or at least they were scared of the sun. I think the sun, although it's a created thing, needs to be respected nonetheless. They called it Ra. You guys know this, Ra. Okay, so what's interesting when I read a couple of commentaries, Pharaoh is actually the Ra in Pharaoh is actually Ra. Okay, so their leader is connected with the god, the sun god, and the sun god is respected tremendously, and here they're saying God created the sun. Now there's a guy Art. Well, he's a guy. His first name is Art. What his second name is, I'm not sure. And he says that maybe this might be some social commentary on that, in that you've got the light and you've got the light in the beginning, but only on the fourth day you have the sun. So it's not even, if you take the chronology of Genesis, as if they're doing very well. They're actually quite bad because firstly, they're not gods, and they were created on the fourth day. That is shocking. I mean, as an Egyptian, I would be annoyed by then, but at least make us first, if I'm not a god. At least put us in the first day. But it doesn't happen. So a first century person reading or hearing this text would say, don't tell it to the Egyptians. They are going to be very upset if you tell them that the sun is not a god. A second thing that might upset a couple of people would be that humans can command other creatures. They are the pinnacle of creation. That would have upset a lot of people. Because even today, there's a lot of other stuff that has a higher value than humans, created things. Well, as we can imagine the ocean, but other animals. I mean, I'm talking a little bit without referencing it, but I would imagine a cow is pretty high on the list in a place like India. So it is not necessarily a given that humanity is the cream of the crop, okay? There's a lot of places, I mean, to use Egypt as an example, they, for some very obscure reasons, thought very high of cats, okay? So you have various animals being above humanity, and here come these Jews, these desert-walking, weird people who are very stuck up, they're not allowed to party like the rest of the world, they tell us that humanity is the top on the top of creation, not other animals. This would have been shocking to a first-century reader, not a first-century reader, a first-time reader. And then God is saying it is good. Now, creation, remember what I told you earlier, it was never good. It was always a battle. It was always a fight. It wasn't as if the guy said, so this god killed that god. He used his carcass and his guts to build America, and it was good. It wasn't that scenario. This is a very, like I said, age-restricted, nice version. Everything is good. Everything is fluffy. Everything is birds and flowers, and it's really not hardcore enough. And then the last thing that somebody in the ancient Near East would have picked up immediately is the last bit. So if I ask you, what is the climax of creation? What would you tell me? What is the climax of the creation account?
Man.
Okay. Yeah, Derek says yes, man. Now, Yulindi, you're wrong, and Derek, you were wrong for celebrating it, because it's not man. The climax of the Genesis 1 account is rest. That is the climax. What was done last? And God rested. So it's not man. So although we're pretty special, rest is still above us. And places like Spain and Argentina, who is very fond of siestas, would agree with you that rest is, in fact, above man. No, scrap that last bit. Rest. What is this deal about God resting? You see, somebody living in the ancient Near East would know what's going on here. At that stage, he would say, boom, I figured it out. This is temple language. This guy, who's ever writing Genesis, he's talking about temple. Why? Because a temple is where God rests. Everybody in those days would have known it. We don't think it. We just think, that's why Sundays is a good day. But the first century reader would have just said, first-time reader or ancient Near East reader would have said, this refers to a temple. God is building a temple for himself. And the Bible is actually quite clear on this as well. Check out Psalm 132. It says the following. Let us go to his dwelling place. Let us worship at his footstool. Arise, O Lord, and go to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. Let your priests be clothed with righteousness, and let your saints shout with joy. For the Lord has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his dwelling place. This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it. You see that? So rest is not necessarily God being... And here's the problem. Whenever we talk about God, is we use what they call anthropomorphism. Did I pronounce it correctly? So we try to give human attributes to God. So we say, and God was jealous, which is the closest that we can come to what God is feeling now. Or God changed his mind. Now, if you have any philosophical idea of who God is, then you would realize for God to change his mind was not really is not really possible, although I'm opening up a whole can of worms by saying these things, but we can talk about it later. But so God resting is not God taking a holiday. It is God moving into his residence. So what does that tell us about Earth? What is Genesis 1? What is it primarily telling us? Remember the context it was written to. This is a temple. God just built a temple, and he is going into residence. Now, when we think about resting, if you look at 132, Psalm 132, it refers to God taking office. So when a president takes office in the White House, for example, he goes in, he goes into the Oval Office, he moves into, I think, the Lincoln House or some president's house, and he stations himself there, and he's ready for work. It's much the same language that we have here. And this repetition bit of it was good. A guy called John Walton, I used him a lot for this sermon. He's an Old Testament scholar at Wheaton College in the USA. And he says it's much like a pilot, or you know, a NASA pilot or an airline pilot, when he checks all the things in the airplane. He would say, they will ask him communications. He say good or check or whatever. Let's say steering wheel, check. That's what they say. They'll say seatbelt, check. I imagine it's more sophisticated than seatbelt and steering wheel or whatever. But it's all these things that needs to be in order. And he says, check, good to go, good to go, good to go, good to go. And then we're ready for liftoff. It's much like that. So when God is saying good, 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 he's saying it's ready. He's not saying that it is, oh, that's nice. That's pretty. Wow, so I really outdone myself this time. That's really good. Wow. I must do this more often. It's not that kind of scenario. it is him saying, this is becoming more of my dwelling place. And you know how we know it. You know how we know it is about functionality. Because in Genesis 2, when Adam looks at all the animals, he says, oh, I don't have a friend for myself. Because man should not be alone, and it was not good. Can you see how it's used there? It was not good for man to be alone. So it obviously has to do with functionality. So for this place to be truly ready for God, to, so to speak, to move in, he had to go through this checklist. And again, this opens up a whole can of worms, but we can talk about it a little bit later. So what a guy like John Walton and a lot of other Old Testament scholars would say is that we are so focused on the house story that we forget that Genesis 1 is primarily a story about a home. And what is the difference? If we talk about a house, we talk about the architecture of the house. We talk about the physical attributes of the house. Am I right? But when we talk about a home, we talk about more of the emotional attributes, the character of the people living in there. You understand the difference between a home and a house? And what a lot of commentators would say is that Genesis 1 is an account of a home. It's not necessarily an account of a house. It is not how God did it. It's more a question of why God did it. Because what is the pinnacle of creation? God moves in to his temple. He's not trying to give us a scientific account of what happened. And please, I mean, disagree with me when it's time for questions and comments and everything. But this is primarily a why question. Why is God doing this? He's doing it because he is building a temple for himself. What else can we say about this? This is a song. This is a song. How do we know that Genesis 1 is a song or a poem or something like that? Because of the repetition. If you are writing a historical account, we've got Isabella here, she's a historian. If you write history and you repeat stuff, I would imagine that people will frown at you and you will not get a very good PhD or whatever. So if you say the Voortrekkers came over the mountain, they came over the mountain they walked and they settled at Potgietersrus. They settled at Potgietersrus. They settled there. It was good that they settled there. And then they moved on and they traveled a little bit with their cattle. With their cattle, they moved. With their cattle, they moved to that particular place, to that place that where they was. That is not what you do when you write history. It is what you do when you write a poem. It is what you do when you write a song of some sort. And that's why you have this wonderful repetition happening the whole time. So Genesis 1 is essentially the song of creation. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily history, but it just means that Genesis 1 is a song about history. At the very best, I'm not saying it's history, but at the very best, you must say that it is a song. So it's not trying to give you exact history because of the repetition. And it's not even something that we need higher context for. It's not even something that we can only understand if we go 3,000 years back. It's something that we can understand now because of the repetition. And because we can compare genres, within the Bible, we see how they talk when they talk about history and how they talk in this Genesis 1. So what's the implications of this? What is the implications of Genesis 1? Firstly, and this is something that I'm not trying to say that Genesis is not so important as we initially thought. I'm saying it is way more important than we initially thought. First implication, the world is not a bad place. So God's saying it is good, it is good. He is happy with this world. It says something about this world. Now again, an ancient reader would say, this guy really likes the world. That's weird. Because the ancients were really much more interested in getting away from this world. They were much more interested in going to the gods. So what they did was primarily to please the gods, but they weren't really necessarily interested in the sciences or social justice or building hospitals or really taking care of the people, because their primary task was, listen, thunder, I'm sorry, I will get to burning somebody now so that you can be happy. They were more interested in this level of communication than on a horizontal level. But God says, no, this world is important. This world is very important. That's the first implication of Genesis 1. The second one is that this world is not ultimate. It is not the only thing there is. And that is something that would be shocking to a first century, or a first time, a first, you know what I mean? It would be shocking to them because they would worship animals or certain features within creation. But it is also very shocking to people living in a secular world like we do. Because what do we worship? See, one of the mistakes we make is that we don't, when we stop believing in God, we don't stop worshiping stuff. G.K. Chesterton said, when we stop believing in God, it's not as if we stop worshiping something, it is that we start worshiping everything. Because what is worship? It is what you give ultimate reality to. And if that is your relationship, then that is your God. Then that's what you're worshiping. You're worshiping your spouse, your relationship. If it's money, then that's what you're worshiping. You are worshiping money. If you are worshiping pleasure or sex or whatever it is, then that's what you're worshiping. And if you look at Hollywood, if you look at our world today, then it looks like we have a very religious society. Very religious. If you look at what's going on in Wall Street, those guys are committed believers to money. If you look at the porn industry, they are committed believers to pleasure or whatever. So this has massive implications. It says, yes, this world is important. Yes, you can have fun. Yes, it's amazing. But it's not God. It's not everything. Can you see how relevant Genesis 1 is still for today? Humanity has immense value. I mean, people say that the Bible doesn't have a very high view of humanity. You can't get any higher than we are made in the image of God. That is very, very high. So what's the implications of that? Well, when you say, I don't like black people, I don't like Indians, I don't like this or that, you are going against what Genesis says God is saying about the world. You know what is really funny? You heard Russell Crowe say it, and I mean, anything that Russell Crowe says obviously is true. He says it with his very dramatic, sexy voice, and I mean, even I write love letters occasionally. But he says, Adam and Eve, mother and father of us all. Did you hear that bit? It was right in the end. Then he made Adam and Eve, mother and father of us all. Do you know what a lot of Christian writers over the century said? If you discriminate against any other person, you are discriminating against your brother and sister because we have the same mom and dad. We've got Adam and Eve. You don't discriminate against your brother and sister. You don't go to your biological brother and sister and say, I can't believe where you come from. You come from a primitive background. You come from a primitive house. You can't do that because you come from the same place. You're laughing at yourself. And that is the wonderful theological value of Genesis 1, mother and father of us all. Can you see how relevant Genesis 1 is for today? But remember, when we read the Bible, we compare the Bible with the Bible. It is a hermeneutical tool. It's how we access the Bible. We compare it with itself. And in the beginning, we have that phrase is only used once elsewhere from Genesis 1. Where is that? John 1. So in the beginning, it's only used once outside of Genesis 1, and that is in the Gospel according to John. Let me read it to you. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. I'm going to read it again. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. And without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life. And the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness. And the darkness has not overcome it. You know what John is saying? In that Genesis account, Genesis 1, when God spoke and there was light. Every time God speaks, it's not a voice box. It's not an audible thing. What John 1 is saying is that word, when God speaks, it's not an action, it's an agent. Listen to me. It's not an action, it's an agent. It's a person. So when God speaks, let there be light, in the triune God, he's talking about Jesus. Jesus in this Genesis 1 account. And remember that first bit of Genesis 1, and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. Remember, we're using the Bible to explain the Bible. So we must be talking about the Holy Spirit, the triune God, there in Genesis 1. God spoke. And what John 1 is saying, God created us. He created this temple for humanity to dwell with him. And it's this wonderful, wonderful story. God in his richness, in his love, is making this world and he's putting us in. And he makes us with this person, through this person, in his triunity. That's how we came into existence. But we lost paradise in Genesis 3. And as we go through this Genesis series, you would realize, well hopefully you already realize it, but we lost that unity with God. We lost that paradise with God. But God didn't stop there. So the second time he came and created was in John 1. That's how he starts his gospel. So Genesis 1 is the story of God creating us, this wonderful temple where he's going to dwell with us. Genesis 3 is the story of us losing that unity, that intimacy with God. And you know what the story is, John 1? It's a story of God coming back for us. And if that doesn't give shivers down your spine, I will say it again so that it does. John 1 is a story of God coming back for us. It is the ultimate hero's tale. God make us. Stuff goes wrong. And we're going to talk about that. But God doesn't stop. He begins again. And he comes back for us. And that's why when we read this John 1, he was with God, all things were made through him, and he is the light. It's referencing back to Genesis 1, and it tells us this wonderful thing, that this God is a personal God who came and rescued us. Let's close our eyes. Lord, we apologize that we sometimes miss the forest for the trees, and that we look at the Bible through a 21st century lens, and we try to put words in your mouth, and we try to make stuff out of it that might not be said. Help us to approach the Bible with humility, Lord. Even in today's talk, Lord, that we can still look at it with humility and where we are wrong to accept it. But Lord, thank you for the theological message. Thank you for this profound story of you making us out of love and making a dwelling place for you, making a temple, but not giving up on us, even though we broke that intimacy. Even though we as humans were not interested in that intimacy, you didn't stop there. You came and fetched us. And Lord, that's why we are so glad that this sermon can stop with the cross. Because it started with creation, Lord, and then you came for us. And when we think of the cross, and when we think of what Jesus did, when he spoke in Genesis, he was creating, but when he spoke on the cross, he wasn't heard by anybody. Because he took it on himself, what we deserved. And that just melts our hearts, Lord. Help us to respond to that wonderful, wonderful gift. Help us to live by that. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. I want to play you a song of Gungor. And I'm not even going to say anything about it. Just check it out.
Beauty in the dirt, wandering in skin. There's mystery in the dirt. The metaphors are breaking down. We taste the wind inside a sound.
So what these guys are trying to say is they start off by saying we are mountains, I am mountain, I am dust, constellations made of us. So he's saying that we are part of this creation, we were created. So you have these two enlightened ones, if you will, who realize that God gave them this playground. He gave them this opportunity to play in his world. And then you have these people on the one side who's, say, caught up in not loving this world. We need to be pious. We need to live for this vertical thing. And they go there and they say, no, you're allowed to enjoy this world. And unfortunately, that is how the world sees a lot of Christians, as these people with white clothes, no offense to anybody wearing white, sitting in the field, just trying to make sure that they're okay with this guy up there, so that when they die, they go to a better place than what they are now. We are in the temple of God. And a song like La Gongor just excites me and reminds me of that reality. Friends, that is what I wanted to tell you about Genesis 1. And some of you are sitting here very disappointed because I didn't touch the soppy, hard, the good stuff. But I did it for a reason, because I think that we miss the forest for the trees. And we lose the wonderful theological value of a wonderful text when we are trying to figure out the science that it says, and we are asking the wrong questions to the text. That is what I would say to that particular issue. There's chips that is being carried in now, so if you want some chips, you're more than welcome. If you want some coffee, you're also more than welcome. And if you want to ask a question, you're also more than welcome. Comments or whatever. Yeah, sounds good. Ooh, you need the... let's say...
I have a question. When God created all the animals and everything, then he created them in pairs. But then when he created the humans, he only created one. Was the original plan for there just to be one person ruling everything and then naming everything? And then the plan was changed. Now let's give him a girlfriend, kind of.
That is an incredible question. And I can honestly say I've never thought about that. If you guys have something to say to Sunscreen, I would really encourage that. But in the last, so the question was, God creates animals in pairs, but humanity, he only creates Adam, and then he without a Mikey, and then only when Adam is depressed, he gives him a friend, and another a pair to make it a pair. In the last 5.5 seconds that I thought about your question, I would say that perhaps it is a literary device to say that the way that animals connect with their pair, with their other, is primarily on an intercourse type of relation. It doesn't have the same sort of intimacy that humanity has with the other person. So it is a literary device to say that man cannot exist without somebody else, not necessarily in the reproduce sexual sense of the word, but in an intimacy sense of the word. And perhaps the intimacy that that person can have with another person reflects something of the image of God. So maybe it has to do something with the fact that being made in the image of God means that his relationship with the other animals is not the same. It's something else. It's a question of intimacy. It is something that reflects the Trinity of God as well. So maybe, just maybe, it's an attempt to show, you see, humanity is even special. I'm not going to put him in pairs with the rest of the animals because it's a different kind of love. That would be my guess. But if you other guys, if you have thoughts on that, please let me know. Or you can ask a different question. Don't let Sonskane's question hijack the entire evening. But that is a very, very good question, Sonskane. You are obviously sitting in front of the classroom. Yes, Tani Christine.
How do you know that they were in pairs initially? Because it's only with Noah that they're known to be in pairs. Maybe when God chose a mate for the man, he also created for the animals. Because as far as I know, I don't have my Bible with me. Maybe others are mates. So I don't know. But I obviously think because of what you're making, I don't know, maybe there's a standard that they may be making.
I'm trying to check now. I only have the Message translation in front of me, so it's not necessarily species and flying. It just says all kinds, all animals of every kind, cattle of all kinds, every sort of reptile and bug. So it doesn't necessarily say that they came in mates. So perhaps all animals were male before the fall. So yeah, that's a brilliant question, Sonskan, and thanks for that, Tani Christine. Yes, Tamang.
Yeah, I like when you read the verse 26 of Genesis 1, going down with it, it says God created in his likeness, he created male and female. Mm. So like I support the sister when she says that he created the opposite sex also, like he created male and female.
Mm-hmm.
So, but my question was on the point of when you said that the climax is about the rest. So, like you said, you mentioned something. You said something about to check everything before you take on a ride in a car. So, and then you said that God, he checked everything. His point was not to mean that wow, everything is overwhelming, is good, but then he was saying that he was checking whether everything is functional and is okay before he can take rest. So I'm interested in the point of his rest, where God take reside, where is he resided?
Okay, so Tabang, thanks for that question. Maybe I oversimplified it by saying that he was not impressed with what he saw. Because obviously, God being infinitely happy within himself wouldn't create something that, oh, I don't necessarily like that. So I was trying to mock that point, maybe incorrectly, by just stating that it is not primarily about that. Because most sermons that you would hear on this and most explanations would be, it was so very good. It was well done. That's a very good waterfall. But it's more about God. It's more about the checklist, a literary device again, saying that God is building His temple. He's ready to move in. So it's a question of functionality. And again, remember what I told you about the home house difference. He's saying more about this is becoming a home. This is becoming a home. And remember, when it is really a home, some would say that a home is only a home when the children comes in. You know, when they become part of the family, then it's a home. So his home goes with the you've got the 6-day. Man is created. They can share in this infinite joy that God has in the Trinity, and then he goes and rest, because now it's a home. Now I can occupy this world. So Tabang, that's what I tried to say. And then after that, resting doesn't mean passive. That is not what this the Genesis is saying. It's not saying that now God is absent. Now God is on holiday. And that's why I read to you Psalm 152, because it says God is going to rest in the temple, but in the more literal translation, it says he will ascend his throne. If you ascend the throne, what do? You govern. You run your empire. So that is basically what God is saying. He's resting there, and he's running his empire. It's not a contradiction in that passage. And we, as humanity, as image bearers, are tasked with running as his subordinates to run this creation. And it's a wonderful privilege to run his creation for him. So I think, Tabang, I hope I answered your question a little bit. That's what I was trying to allude to there. Herman het 'n vraag en oom het 'n vraag.
Yeah, thanks, Johan. I appreciate that you describe that Genesis is actually considered to be a poem or even a mythological story, how God would see his home and where we fit in and how we relate to each other. That's how I understand it as well. But that has other implications. That means Adam and Eve would be also fictitious people or mythical people, not real people. And that would also mean, what do you call it, Sonderfall? What's that in English?
Fallen, yeah, everybody understands.
But in any case, that would also mean...
It's because of the fall that I couldn't translate.
The fall is also part of the poem or story, which never really happened. And that's got the knock-on effect as far further we go. So
okay.
Can you maybe comment on that?
Please. Well, I don't know why I said please, but yes. I read Genesis 1. I didn't read Genesis 2 and 3 today. So I didn't make any comment about the rest of Genesis being a poem, necessarily. So if you look at, I think it's Exodus 17, God has just taken the Israelites out of Egypt through the Promised Land, and I would view that as a historical thing that happened. Okay, so they are gone, and it's wonderful, and everybody's happy. But then in Genesis 8, in Exodus 18, they sing a song about it. They sing a song, and they're very excited about the fact that they are out of Egypt. So a song about something doesn't necessarily discredit its historicity. That's the first thing that I would say. So a guy like Tim Keller, that I have massive respect for, and he's also rather conservative. And I would, you know, distance myself on a couple of issues. But he says it is quite obvious that that Genesis 1 is a poem. It's not history. And he would reference guys like Jonathan Edwards, who's so conservative, you know, he would look, he would make, I don't know, Urania look like a liberal hippie place. And he says, yeah, it's a poem, but Genesis 2 is history. So this is a poem about history. So I think it's perfectly legitimate for a conservative person to hold a view that although I don't have to take Genesis 1 literal, although I can say it's a poem, I can still say that in Genesis 2, I've got more of a historical account, and therefore they don't necessarily contradict one another. That is not necessarily my view. All I'm saying is that you can hold both of them together. I don't think, firstly, that to take Genesis 1 to 11, for example, to take it as a metaphor has any implications on the truth of that particular issue. I don't think it has an issue. It doesn't mean that I hold to that position, but I know a lot of respected Christians who holds that position. A guy like Francis Collins, head of the Genome Project. A guy like C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis is a very, very conservative, well-known Christian, and he would say that as a scholar of literature, it's quite obvious, in his words, that Genesis 1 to 11 it's got a mythical element. But also in his literature genre, he would say, but I know the Gospels, and I know that that's history. So I can still be a Christian, even though I don't take that as literal. So what I'm trying to say is I'm trying to propagate a compatibilist view, saying that I don't think we need to fight about it. I don't think we should not talk about it. But I think both is one can hold. A last point I would make on that is that Genesis 3, when people tell me, Yuan, how can you believe in an ancient text? And according to your view, according to your Bible, I am being punished for what people did 6, 7, 8,000 years ago in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve. I've got nothing to do with that. Billy Joel, piano man guy, he's got this quote where he says, when he went into Christianity and they told him that he's under sin because Adam and Eve sinned, he said, I've got nothing to do with that. Don't put that sin on me. Now, that's oversimplifying the issue. Because if you look at Adam and Eve, and if you actually check out that clip that I played of you from the Noah movie, it tells it so well. Adam and Eve's story is the story of all of us. It's all of our story. That does not necessarily mean that it was not historical, but it's much more than that. Because it's the story of all of us. If you think about what's going on there, it's these guys not trusting God. Not trusting God, that God has their best interest at heart. God is hiding something from us. What do we do as humans when God tells you, don't go sleep around? Maybe God is hiding something from me. I want to go sleep around. I want to have fun. Maybe God is hiding something from me. What do? We eat the forbidden fruit. What if I really need to go into this business, and I'm just telling a small lie in getting this big deal. It's really not a big deal that I'm getting the big deal. So let me just do my business this way. And you know what? I mean, why would God really want me to be poor? So I don't trust God, and I go for it. Can you see how we are Adam and Eve every day? And it would be a massive oversimplification to only look at it from a historical level. And I fear that we've lost the massive relevance of Adam and Eve and most of Genesis because we are always trying to fight with, how historical is it? How should we see this? A last comment that I would make on that is that if it is historical, the writer of Genesis doesn't care to explain himself. He doesn't care to elaborate on it. So when we ask questions, and we'll get to that, when they were chased out of the garden, they met other people there. Okay, when did God make them? The Genesis author, well, anybody would tell you, he couldn't care less. What do you tell you there? He's not interested in giving you that piece of information. So at the very least, what we must do is we mustn't read too much into this text. We should let it read us rather than the other way around. And so in summary, I would say that I think there's a compatibility. There's a compatibility by saying that Genesis 1 is a song, but from Genesis 2, it's a historical account. That is one, and a lot of good Christian thinkers hold that view. I think it is also acceptable to think that that Genesis 1 to 11 might be mythological, but from there on in, it moves into history because it's a genre difference. And I know a lot of brilliant Christians who hold that view. And lastly, I would say, if we are only going to fight about the historical issue of this thing, we are going to lose this wonderful theological depth that's in there. And I'll rest with that last point. Ooh, God.
You said that the climax is God resting.
Okay.
But that's about the final part of the poem, right?
Well, that's where the repetition seems to stop. So yeah, I think a lot of scholars would say that.
Now, I agree with the whole the earth is his temple and he's living here, and I don't think it affects that. But that's not how stories work. If you ask the people who did English literature here or who teach it or whatever, you have your climax and then you have your denouement, your ontknoping, your afloop, right? So so I would read it as God makes man, climax, and then denouement, he rests. Like The Lord of the Rings, which is a story you would know, Frodo, Gollum, Mount Doom, the ring falls in, story ends, right? No, it doesn't. He's got a very long denouement, actually. After that, because they have to go back to the Shire and fight the people in the Shire, and then they get on the boat and they go to the Grey Havens, right? Frodo going to the Grey Havens is not the climax of Lord of the Rings. God resting is not the climax of the poem. It's also quite interesting, if you look at it from a functional ontology point of view, which John Walton does, so God checks all the buttons, right? The pilot gets in, checks everything, right? Ready for takeoff, and then he rests. That doesn't make sense to me. So I don't think it changes the story, but I'd like to hear your view of that. Because, I mean, John Walton isn't an idiot. He's quite clever. But that, I mean, it doesn't fit. What would you say?
Well, let's use the Lord of the Rings analogy. If you've ever tortured yourself by reading Lord of the Rings, it's a wonderful torture, but it is a torture nonetheless. You would notice that within this massive book, people sing songs, okay? Usually you skip pages, okay? Still singing, still rhyming, still whatever, and then you go on with the rest of the story. So within the story are various segments. So I'm not saying that God's story stopped in Genesis 1. That would have made Bible reading much easier. It goes on. But I do think that it's a story within a story. And a lot of scholars would tell you that Genesis 2 and Genesis 1 are two different stories. The one is older than the other one. So they are put next to each other, but they don't follow necessarily. Because remember, these things were orally given from one person to the next. So it was a couple of stories that came together. That doesn't take anything away from the credibility of it. But I think what I would say to that is it's a story within a story. It's a poem within a bigger story. And again, God resting is actually very much, say, coherent with the rest of the story because he's taking up office. That's why I read Psalm 132. He's moving into this creation, and then it's Paradise Lost, and now it's the story again of God coming back to take ownership of his people. He starts again, and they must build him a tabernacle because he wants to move with his people again. And then this temple becomes a person in John 1. That's the other thing we didn't say about John 1 is it actually says he didn't move between us. It says he tabernacled between us. He templed between us. So that's the awesome story. Genesis 1, God makes his temple. We lose it. We lose that intimacy with him. Then he starts over. He says, okay, I want my tabernacle again with you. You must realize that I'm holy. Do this, do this. Don't do that. Cease. I'm holy. I'm holy. I'm holy. They realize it. And then all of a sudden Jesus comes. He says, I'm going to give you my full revelation. I'm going to give you everything. And it says that God, Jesus comes and temples between us. And that's why he says the temple will be destroyed and it will rise up again. So then it went full circle. So Herman, I'm not sure whether I answered you, but that's at least how I would understand it. I can hear the microphone. Yes, you want?
I just want to make a comment on the concept of mythology. Lots of people take mythology to mean stories sucked out of somebody's thumb.
Yeah.
That's not the scientific view of mythology.
Yeah.
Mythology is a story that's about the interaction between gods and humans that takes place in mythical time. And it also contains a lot of other elements like shamanism, revelation, prophecy, and things like politics that also get subsumed into mythology. Mm. So in other words, you cannot just say that mythological stories means that it's not true in a certain sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got a base in reality that is different from a story. So we shouldn't use mythology to mean fictional story. We should use it rather to talk about an interaction between human and divine.
Absolutely. Thanks, Juan. That's perfect. I mean, even Jesus' parables, when you read commentaries on those parables, he's taking literal issues within their world that they would understand. And he's telling stories about very real things. So thanks, Juan. Yes, Derek.
Okay. So I want to enter into the debate about what the climax is. And I would like man to be the climax because I'm a man and that's just how it is. It was interesting to think of this, Sunday being the climax, specifically because God then told the Israelites, you will rest on the seventh day because in 7 days I created the world. And there's a bit of a resting in the sufficiency of God that we work for 7 days, and sorry, for 6 days, and then on the seventh day we rest. There's nothing which we can add to creation which God has not already done. So there is a sense for me where it is, I know I can rest that God has provided. If in Hebrews it says he's the author and the finisher of our faith, he's also the one who continues and finishes. I mean, when the job is finished, it's done. It's complete, and I can rest in that. There's nothing I can do that can bring me then closer to him in a sense. I don't work for my salvation. It's something that's given. So that's something that I would like to add anyway.
Okay, Derek. Okay, guys, we need to... the second to last one.
Okay. Yeah, if we use the word climax like you're using it, it's sits inside a whole lot of theory that's come after that was written probably, you know. So I think what you were trying to say is actually that it's important. It's an important part of the story. And if you think about, for there to be a climax, it fits within a story where we start off with an equilibrium, then that equilibrium gets shifted or bothered or whatever, and then there's some kind of conflict, and then something happens that's good, and then equilibrium is restored, but it's a higher equilibrium or a better equilibrium. And I think that's what happens in the story. And so God resting is the new equilibrium or the resolution to the story, which makes it more important than the climax. The climax in the story is actually just there to get us to the resolution or the better equilibrium. So I think it's a matter of semantics. I don't think it takes away from the point that he's trying to make.
Perhaps when we use the word climax, just there's a couple of aggressive people there at the back. When we talk about climax, what I'm trying to say is that I think that last day, that seventh day, tells you what the rest of this is about. So it's not necessarily chronologically. I say, okay, God's rest is more important than man. So that's how we should see it. I don't think it's about it. It's just what the commentators would say, ah, when God says that, they say, oh, so this is what he was busy doing. He was building a temple. So it's not a chronological thing. Yes.
Johan, I somewhere in my history read a book on Genesis as well. Can't remember who wrote it or whatever, but I remember that I registered the fact that if you do the literally study of Genesis 1, then you won't actually find indicators there that it is meant to be poetry. Now, obviously, that could have been wrong. I can't even remember who wrote it. But, you know, if repetition alone was a guide to realizing whether something's a poem, then Oscar Pistorius is also a poet because he was repeating My Lady so many times in his cross-examinations and all those things. Can you just quickly tell us what else in Genesis 1 indicates that it's actually poetry, apart from the repetition?
The form, I would say, it's got to do with it. So it tells us in exactly the same way. Every one day follows the same. I'm not sure if we call it parallelism. Say again. Pattern. It follows the same pattern as the one before it. Plus, it's there's a. It's just a poem, man. Yeah. So if in Afrikaans, if you paid attention in your poem classes of your poesie. That I obviously didn't. you see that in tweer, that formula of how the thing is building up, repetition, and I mean there's other places where repetition happens. I'm not saying that so Jesus was actually reciting a poem when he asked Peter whether he will be the leader of the church. Will you do this, Peter? And York's all. And so they're doing York's all. When he was confronting him after his resurrection. I'm not saying that that's a poem, but obviously the context of that allows me to say, no, Jesus really did repeat this thing three times, and he was referencing to the fact that Peter denied him three times. So there's repetition, and even an idiot like me can say, okay, well, that's not a poem. But when you see this, I just think that when I have conservative commentators telling me that, listen, I believe that Genesis is historical. I'm just saying that Genesis 1 is a poem, and Genesis 2 is a is more of a historical account. That's the one side. The other thing is that Genesis 1 doesn't seem interested in being coherent. So when it says that there was light before the physical sun, then obviously it doesn't seem to be interested in being coherent because there can't be light without the sun. And then you go on. And I know that Young Earth has done some what I call hermeneutical gymnastics to get around that. But the second thing is, in Genesis 2, verse 5, they would say, in the day that God created the heavens and the earth, it's the same word, it's yom. So he's very liberal in how he puts the story together. He's not interested in making scientific sense out of it. That's why I would say that this guy is not interested in putting this thing together to make sure it matches, scientifically speaking, even by their scientific view, even by their standards, that would be bit of a mismatch. So yeah, that's the best I can do. Guys, we are running a little bit out of time. I'm not trying to hide away from your questions. Is there still one? Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to use this mic. It's fine. You're breaking here. We've got a bit of a problem there. If we look at it only from a poetic point of view, in that. It opens a can of worms in terms of interpretation of scripture. You know, the virgin birth of Christ. You know, going back to the Genesis account, the 24-hour literal day, Yom, as you just referred to it now. Mm-hmm. The problem that I have with that, if you interpret that not fundamentally as a fundamentalist chronologically, you have to be careful not to open for the gap theory or evolution.
which will inevitably follow the belief of a poetic or a poetry type of theme. Later in the Bible, we remember that typology plays a big role. In the beginning, God created Bereshit Bara Elohim Alefta. Christ is in there, the pierced hand of God who saved man. I think it's important that one should look at nobody was there, and I think if repetition there doesn't necessarily give us an indication of, well, it doesn't exclude the fact that it was a literal event. What it tells us is the mystery of God is beyond our conscience, that we don't even understand how the creation and how he created it. So science, later on, actually uses of the account in Genesis to add to certain understandings which they never knew. So that's where that should be hand in hand. Just a few comments. On the man creating him was not good for the wife there, for Eve. Remember he said, bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, which refers to that is part of me, and that's as you answered there on the triunity, communication of that as well. And then the last thing, I always ask myself the question, what is the most important thing for God? And the answer, you know, we might think is to love one another, not to sin, but there's a sovereign answer to that. The most important thing to God is God. So he is the pinnacle and he is the climax. And having that as the prime understanding, then the pinnacle or the climax of creation is for man to be in fellowship with God, to have a relationship with him, not the man. Although man, being a created being, is the highest of his creation.
Okay, yeah, thanks for that. I would agree with most of the second stuff, the second two comments you made. But I don't think that we need to worry about interpreting Genesis 1 or whatever, because that's going to give us difficulties with other issues. Because I don't think that Genesis 1 cares about anything about our science. Plus, if it cares about our science, then it means that we are only able to understand that when our science catches up with this. But what about the rest of the world? I think it's pretty obvious that the biblical writers were under the impression that we have a three-story universe. You have hell beneath us, you've got the earth here, and you've got the gods above. So when they say that there was a himmelgewelf, the blue on top there, was the waters being separated from the waters, they weren't trying to make a scientific statement. They were making a statement about the worldview of all the people that lived in the ancient Near East in that day. That is how they understood that world. Now we say, okay, but why didn't God write that as science that we would understand? Well, the fact of the matter is, then it means that only the last couple of years of people would be able to fully grapple what they were saying. Why? And again, in terms of the sovereignty of God, maybe we should not ask God why he didn't give us, you know, the science, but why didn't you tell us exactly what had happened? Why didn't you tell us how the Big Bang works, how quarks worked, how the Higgs boson, all of these things? Because according to that view, the people who would have heard it for the first, say, 19 centuries wouldn't have had a clue what he was talking about. So he tells this story within a worldview that the people that heard it for the first time understood it. So that is what I would say with respect to that. But apart from that, I would also say that in Isaiah, I think it's 45, they say the world is caught in a sphere. And then now a lot of people would say, and especially young earth enthusiasts would say, that you see, that is a scientific statement in Isaiah, saying that the earth is round. How on earth would they have known that the earth is round without the technology that we have today? But that is actually an incorrect translation, because he was talking about the sphere of the flat earth that everybody thought. Aristotle, Plato, all the intelligent people of those days were under the impression that it was a sphere, but it was still flat. It was that kind of sphere. So if we read into it now, saying, we know it's a sphere, they predicted it, it's wonderful, I'm thinking we're doing something irresponsible with the text. That is my view. please disagree with me and assault me and you know, give me in for heresy at the church place. Guys, that is going to be the end. Sorry for going so late, but that's what happens when you have controversial topics. If you are very upset at the moment, there's coffee outside, there's some chips, there's some books you can stroll and check out, and remember that love conquers all. And next week, Rudolf is going to talk to us, by the way, on the theology of ecology, which is a very, very important issue. In other words, what we termed it, why Genesis wants you to plant a tree. This is a massive issue and something that the church really needs to catch up on. So that's going to happen next week. Please continue the conversation.